Coming up today, laboratory-grown blood and the transfusion technology suitable for Jehovah's Witness. Plus, mathematicians have built an app that could help you combat long-distance jet lag using maths. And how would you like to simulate what your baby's face will look like at 60 years old? Good news, face fans, it's about to become possible. All that plus your comments and thoughts in the feedback loop coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to international travel and little baby faces. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Leah Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And you'll notice we're sans Olivia underscore Solon because she's got a new doge. A new dog. Bow wow, old
we
friend.
Still haven't decided how to say that, have we?
Let's
haven't.
Not start that up
no.
again.
The dog,
she's got a puppy.
She has. It's called Beazle. I was hoping she'd name it Nate or podcast, or I actually suggested Andromeda, our nearest galactic neighbour, but she's having none of it. She's like, no, it's called Beazle. It's a little French bulldog. So Liv will be back next week, but she's currently getting beasts injected. Couple of points of interest. If you want to hear about the first 10 years of podcasting, I did a two-part radio show for Radio 4, BBC Radio 4, with Ollie Mann and Helen Zaltzman and various other people talking about the first 10 years of podcasting. And it's on iPlayer. If you Google podcasting the first 10 years, you can listen to both episodes and learn about the initial decade of podcasting's life. And also, I did Nosillacast with a lovely woman in America called Alison Sheridan, who I think listens to the podcast, and we talked about everything from tech and how UK trends relate to US trends. We talked about Cowdale, which is where I relax in the country several times a year, and just general life stuff. And that's if you search for Nosilla, N-O-S-I-L-L-A cast, it's Alison backwards, then you will find it. And with that, the news. This week, we have talked about jet lag. It's a pain in the ass. It's also one of the major drawbacks of long-haul travel. It's been accepted as an inevitable drag for years now, despite attempts to knock it on the head. But good news! Mathematicians from the University of Michigan are attempting to change this by releasing an app they claim will help you banish jet lag in record time. But I think it's worth understanding what jet lag is. Liat, would you agree?
I would, Nate.
Good.
Can you explain to us, please?
I can explain to you in a pair of sentences, maybe a trio. Let's find out. Basically, it is caused when our internal, it's this thing called circadian rhythm, I remember listening to a podcast about that once, gets disrupted by crossing time zones too rapidly. And light is the primary signal that affects this. It's a 24-hour biological cycle, and travelling long distances means our bodies are exposed to light and dark when they aren't expecting it. Obviously, that doesn't happen in daily life because light and dark is fairly evenly balanced. Well, actually, it's not that even, depending on the time of year. But and the effects of this obviously are lower levels of cognitive awareness, changes in mood, general grogginess, feeling like you've got the flu if you fly out and back into Tokyo, which is how I always feel flying there. But this research has shown that research has shown that a prolonged exposure, if you like, to jet lag can cause medical issues that are really, really difficult to recover from. So it's good to get jet lag knocked on the head. Enter the app. And these mathematicians from the University of Michigan have called their app N-Train, and it stimulates your circadian clock by making optimal lighting recommendations that will help you dramatically, allegedly, reduce the amount of time it takes your body to adjust to a new time zone.
Problem is, you're rarely in the situation where you can just switch your lighting needs, like say you're in the office.
How does it deal with that?
Yeah.
Yes, well, it's done on existing mathematical models. The team over there had determined that over 1,000 different schedules could be used to quickly overcome jet lag. And the schedules essentially make allowances for a whole loads of lighting levels, those that are found indoors, those even found by shift workers who work often long shifts or work night shifts and things like that. All those with circadian disorders, some people do have that. And there's no naps needed, no bright flashing lights are necessary either. It's just re-establishing your circadian rhythm. It's a very interesting approach to jet laggage. So search for jet lag mathematician, if you like, on wired.co.uk, and you'll find the backstory and obviously links and so forth. Liat.
Nate.
Lab-grown human blood.
Delicious.
The bane of the life or unlife of a vampire, perhaps. But it may reduce dependencies on blood donors. This is only good. Requests for donated blood are only ever seem to be going up. Could yeah. this solve this medical crisis?
Well, that is the hope. I spoke to a member of a team from the Scottish, well, she works under the Scottish National Blood Transfusion Service, and she said in 20 years' time, we might actually be living in a world where blood is manufactured on a mass scale rather than donated. They've made a really quite epic progress in the last few years. She's part of a team working on growing lab blood and has just been awarded £5 million to bring this towards human trials in 2016, which is astonishing considering 6 years ago it was just a proof of principle. They've managed to get to a stage now where they can make about 5 milliliters of blood in around 30 days from pluripotent stem cells.
5 milliliters of blood in 30 days. Mm. That does sound like a very small amount still. I mean, I think
guys,
we transfuse over...
like changing the world. It can't happen overnight.
I'm not saying that that's not good. I'm just saying 2016 seems remarkably close.
That's for human blood trials, though. For human blood, for human trials, you need one unit. So they can already make that now.
So it would then be a case of sort of scaling it up after it's been proven that
exactly,
it's possible.
Exactly. I mean, they know it is possible. And I mean, they obviously have to go through a lot of regulatory steps to ensure that this is as good as the real thing. But you know, as far as they're concerned, this is better. This is young, fit blood. You know, no chance of any kind of infection being transmitted, which happens very rarely in this country. But that, you know, they can, because it's young blood, if you compare it to a donor's blood, you know, of all ages. Mm. I don't know what the average age of a blood donor is, but they're probably not 12.
No. I think you have to be over 18, don't you?
Mm.
Anyway.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure there's a lot of... But basically, the quality is going to be generally higher, and the hope is for people who suffer from illnesses where they need blood transfusions quite often, it could reduce hospital visits for them because they won't need the transfusions as frequently because this blood's just better.
But I mean, is it blood that's being given to any particular person, or is this kind of general usage blood in the broadest possible sense? I mean, is there any particular person that's going to get this?
No, well, I think first it would be groups like that. They'll target groups where it could be a cost-saving scheme, you know, for the NHS, if they have someone who suffers from a disorder where they need to have blood transfusions frequently, it will start with them. But obviously, as you scale up, I think the idea is that you'll hit a balance whereby the cost of producing this stacked up against the cost of dealing with blood donations, which is a big cost. You know, obviously you have to take the donations, you have to verify that the blood's okay, you have to store it. It can only be stored for 35 days. Mm. So you're going to have to, you know, there's a lot of cost that goes into that. And then as that balance tips, then hopefully one day it can be a kind of a global replacement.
I have a question. Developing world, developing nations, could it benefit there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is kind of the, you know, their goal, their ultimate goal. I think that something like 150,000 women die every year in developing countries from childbirth just due to blood loss. And a lot of places won't have the same kind of stringent procedures that we have in checking blood transfusions. But it's the cost. You'll have to get a manufacturer on board to agree to this and bring it down. And if you think for a second just about what kind of level this is at, there's between 1 and 2 trillion red blood cells in one unit of blood. So this is like...
How much is a unit? A pint? A litre?
It can be... No, it's not even a litre. I think it's like 300 millilitres or something.
Wow.
Yeah. But I think she was talking about the five millilitre unit. I mean, it's an astonishing amount. So, you know, we're a fair way off that. I thought it was kind of optimistic saying 20 years. But considering they've come as far as they have in 6 years, you never know.
Well, have a look at lab-grown human blood on Wired.co.uk's little search bar. You will find our story. Katie, I learnt a new word this week.
What was that, Nate?
I love ooh words, and so I was really excited about this one. Smooth food, because it has a double-barreled ooh. So I was naturally very excited that we got to publish this word in several places in an article that you wrote about how the EU has funded 3D printing for smooth food for care homes.
Yes, indeed. So the European Union is investing nearly £2.5 million in a project which is calling Performance. And the idea is that they're going to develop 3D printed smooth food for people in care homes who suffer from problems related to mastication and swallowing.
Question?
Yes.
What the hell is smooth food?
I was just about to get to that.
Ah.
Smooth food is basically food that's been cooked, pureed, strained, and then mixed with a solidifying agent. And after that, they sort of press it into moulds until it resembles the original product. So the idea is that it does actually taste the same.
But it's the texture is going to horrify you if you're...
Possibly. But actually, it could be a really good alternative because what they're doing at the moment, for especially in care homes for people who suffer from these kind of problems, is that they're just feeding them kind of blended up food instead, because it's easier and it's cheaper.
And not so, at all appealing.
Yeah. So this is basically already taken off in Germany. It's already in 1,000 care homes in Germany.
Wow. But where's the 3D printing stuff come in?
Well, this is the thing. So the EU wants to make it easier and cheaper for care homes across Europe to adopt this. And they're trying to incentivize them by making the meals easier to prepare. So what they're doing is they're developing a new solidifying agent, and they're hoping to be able to 3D print in layers the food, which will kind of industrialise the process, if you like, and it will also allow them to adapt to people's dietary requirements and other special needs that they might have, even just their taste preferences, because obviously with blended up meals and so on, there's only a certain amount of kind of things you can blend up and it still be edible.
I like the idea of having a sort of Heston Blumenthal sort of approach to 3D printing food, where if it was connected to a network and you could somehow encourage people to experiment with different 3D printed, not necessarily designs, but formulas and things like that, you wouldn't need to be a food preparation guru, if you like. You would just need to know how to download files and
exactly,
things to make these machines do.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, I like the word because of just how it sounds coming out of my mouth, but actually it's the stuff going in the mouth that really could make a difference
exactly,
to a lot of people.
Yeah.
That sounded like a pre-prepared joke. Sorry, I wasn't intended. But it's true.
Yeah,
I think it could make a big difference from what we've heard in Germany.
Yeah, because the problems, it's really hard to kind of get your head around this. But if you don't suffer with eating problems, but for a lot of old people, they actually start to, it causes them so much pain that they actually start to dread. They stop looking forward to their meals, which is something that I just can't get my head around at all, because that's basically most of my joy in life comes from eating. It's kind of helping them look forward to their meals again and increasing their quality of life. And this has led in some cases where people have just lost their appetite because they haven't been able to eat or they've dreaded eating, and it's led to malnutrition. So this has the potential to really kind of overcome all those problems.
I'm going to go off show notes piece here, but it does make me think back to what the guys in the US are doing with Soylent, which
is kind of the opposite. Really.
It is, in a way. I mean, I'm a big fan of, you know, food is fuel. It's human fuel, and I don't take a great deal of pleasure in preparing meals. I just need nutrition on a plate into my body and to keep the machine
ticking. This is the absolute opposite.
Ticking.
This is for people who are, you know,
who want to like it.
To survive, and also,
but it's
you need
two
to have it
two concurrent
appealing
revolutions in food preparation that amount to similar things, I guess, in a way.
Yes,
breaking food down,
exactly,
putting it back. Well, let us know what you think. Obviously, podcast@wired.co.uk. We have a story on the website. If you search for smooth food, that is all one word. It is a compound word. Search for smooth food on wired.co.uk to learn more. Last up in the news section, very excited about this. The next David Attenborough documentary is being filmed for Oculus Rift.
Woo!
For those of you who do not know what Oculus Rift is, you haven't been listening to the podcast closely enough, you should check back. But it is a virtual reality headset that allows for free, open, 360-degree movement in video games primarily, but also in various other applications such as medical applications and education and stuff like that, and apps now that Facebook owns Oculus VR, which makes these headsets social environments as well. But this is a new series that's being produced under the name Conquest of the Skies, and it's going to be on Sky 3D, but also it's being filmed with about 8 cameras on a rig that means that all the stuff that's being captured can be presented in a virtual reality environment. So you could watch David Attenborough presenting to you, and you can move your head around and you can look around the environment. And that to me is, some people say, what do you want for Christmas?
That.
Traditionally it's my tooth front teeth. More recently it's new bedding. This year it is definitely 3D David Attenborough experiences.
I'm so excited by this.
Yeah, me too.
I can't wait until they have an Antarctic one. And yeah, I want to have,
I want to have
the polar bear breathing on my face.
I was so excited last year when you went to Japan. To go to the opening of Orbi, yeah. Which I guess is a similar thing, but you know, you're experiencing
it's similar in a way.
Not quite as immersive.
The difference is in Orbi, which is kind of an experimental natural history theme park that I wrote about last year. You go into Orbi and you walk around it. This is sort of the other way around. It's more like shrinking Orbi down and then wearing it on your face. The experience, I guess, is quite similar. It's very immersive and it will bring you closer to David Attenborough and his subjects. And that gets me very, very excited, Leah.
Me too.
I cannot wait. When are we going to get an Oculus Rift?
It'll be later this year. I'm sure we have one, actually.
We don't. Do we?
Do we not? I don't know. That's a side
tangent. We probably know someone who does.
We'll come back to that. But yes, let us know what you think. Are you excited by this? And what other sorts of documentaries? Because we've said this before, actually, that documentaries are some of the best candidates for VR.
Definitely.
Because it is something you want to be immersed in. Do you want to be immersed in Coronation Street? Like, you know the fronts of those houses are flat. There's
really
nothing behind
do.
Them. It's like staring at an idiot in the face. The lights are on. No one's literally home because they're not homes. But in documentaries, you could really explore that environment.
Yeah. Horror films.
Although some documentaries, I'm thinking, you know, some that I've seen, quite frightening. I quite like the fact that there's a screen between me and whatever's going on.
Things about the apocalypse.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
You don't want to be hit in the face with an asteroid.
Yeah. No. I'd like to be in a Poirot episode with Oculus Rift and like peer inside people's jacket pockets and test it. Yeah, okay.
Whose pockets would you like to peer inside? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. Still to come up, we have a couple of fantastic segments to get through, and we are going to start by telling you about your child's future face.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now, we have a pair of segments to get into, and the first is a slightly renamed segment. We used to have a segment called WWWTF, decided that that was too specific for the web, but I used to present a podcast that had a segment called WTF, so we've modified this name to make sure that I'm not stepping on old territory. This is WTAF.
What the...
So yes, this is the segment where we talk about things that are just very, very interesting and unusual. What the actual flip. And a team of... In fact, I'm going to let Liat talk about this because you wrote this story.
Didn't actually.
Did you not?
Well, I can't lie.
You can talk about it anyway.
Okay. Olivia wrote this and Nate got very excited about it because I think it got him on a track of how can I genetically engineer my future offspring.
Yes.
That's not, unfortunately, what
we're
talking
about. Well, no, because you have taken my comments out of context. What I said is that I like playing role-playing games, and I like doing this thing called max face or min face, which is when you create an RPG character, you have all these sliders for creating how fat and thin their faces are, skin colours, hair, height.
You want to do that with a real kid.
It's just really funny to ramp all the settings to max and see what it looks like in the game. And I thought it would be interesting to do that with a child. But that's not what this is about, is it?
not entirely. So a team of computer science from computer scientists from University of Washington basically wanted to develop the best software in the world that can generate images of a young child's face at any age throughout their lifetime from just one single photo of them as a baby. And if you are anything like me, and most people in the world, most babies look kind of the same.
Yeah, you're not a baby.
It's quite astonishing.
I'm sorry, you have a job and you can stand on your own two
feet. Baby faces. You can't tell the difference between different baby faces.
That's all true. Babies up to a certain point look the same.
Well, they don't if you know them, but that is just the standard.
Yeah, I suppose you learn the nuances of their faces, but I still see all the, because all my friends are, you know, having babies basically, and it's lots of baby photos, and it's very cute and very sweet, and it's always nice to see. But you could put a kind of a photo lineup, kind of like they'd all done crimes in a row, and say which was the baby you saw today, and I'd be like, could be any.
They've actually found something similar out in this study, so
really?
You're going to be pleased with this. You're not the only one.
Good.
When they started to build the software, which would basically look through thousands of faces online of people the same age and gender and work out kind of the average face according to average pixel arrangements from these random faces. It uses these to calculate the changes between groups as they age. So it can do this from any photo. Doesn't matter the angle or position or lighting, it can accommodate for this. And can do it through any year in their lifetime. Of course, there's plenty of very basic novelty apps where you can age yourself. So they probably thought they nailed it, but they thought perhaps being scientists we should test this. So they did. And they fed the software images of babies. It also had pictures of as teenagers and as adults. And the resulting image of this baby as an adult was then shown to volunteers via Amazon's Mechanical Turk, along with pictures of the individual as a baby and real images of them as an adult. So they had to choose which picture they thought looked most like the baby. And basically, people could go either way. It looked the same to them. So about 37% picked the software generated image and 44% picked the real image. 15% thought it was equally likely to be the baby grown up.
Good figures.
I know.
Supportive figures that yeah. this works. What's the point though? I mean, we sort of teased that if you had a baby, you could see what he or she would look like aged. Well, but, I mean, is it going to be a practical thing?
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, the police use age-generated images for missing children all the time. And, you know, there's quite a few people working on this, not just novelty apps. I think they actually compared an image that was produced by a team at University of St. Andrews who developed similar software, and apparently this team's software trumps them all, and they think they're the best. Stephen Seitz said his age progression results are so convincing that people can't distinguish them from reality. When shown images of an age progressed child photo and a photo of the same person as an adult, people are unable to reliably identify which one is the real photo. They actually started to wonder, like you, is this just because babies, we're just rubbish at telling identifiable features in babies. So they started showing people pictures of babies at different ages, 5 years apart, and then as adults, 5 years apart. And they found out that people really struggle to tell the difference, to identify the accurate image when it was an image of a child. For adults, it's fine. So you now and you 5 years ago, probably about the same, but you 12 and you 7, no, not so much.
I've seen photographs of myself age 21 and can't believe how young I look.
Really?
Yeah.
I've had to get a new passport because I don't look anything like my old passport photo, to the point where I was questioned several times. Just kept getting stopped at airport security.
Now that in the future would actually, if we could do this, if you could almost do a photo fit for what you would look like in the future, you could preempt the fact that you need to change your passport photo or some other future
identification. I don't think we're going to have passport photos in the future.
No?
No.
passports have been around for hundreds of years. They probably deserve to go away now.
It's just ridiculous though, isn't it? If you think about it, they last 10 years. You change a lot in 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, when you're a kid, teenager, young adult. Now, it's just going to go downhill from here, so I wouldn't mind keeping mine.
I think the people that check these, though, are kind of trained to look for certain less obvious things, like nose width, moles, stuff like that, because you could take all my hair off. My hair was much, much longer back then. I didn't have a beard, things like that. I didn't have the sort of pained expression of someone who's worked in London for so many years now, which ages one. frankly. It ages you. But they still believe it's me when I go through passport control. So, who knows? Has your face changed a lot in the last 8 years? Would you find it useful to be able to see maybe what yourself would look like in future using this sort of software? Let us know your thoughts and feedback, podcast@wired.co.uk. Well, the second and final discussion segment of this week's show, it's time to buckle up and ride the Technosaurus. We've got a special guest in the studio for this edition, Ian Morris.
Yes.
Well, welcome, Ian Morris.
It's been a while since we've glanced at each other across a microphone, isn't it, Chief?
It is, actually, yeah. So, Ian, for those not in the know, it's Wired's fifth anniversary today, and we're having a bit of a party this evening. And
Very sophisticated, though, right?
Oh, yes.
It will be very sophisticated, and so we've invited a few people. Ian's coming along, and we thought, Ian, we're talking about gadgets. Ian and I used to host the CNET podcast back in the day.
Indeed.
Many years ago, and so we thought, well, you're here, let's talk gadgets.
I know, and I'm honored, but where are the chairs? Why are there no chairs in this room?
It keeps you on your toes standing up.
It does, doesn't it?
So you have to literally think on your feet.
Yeah, no falling asleep like we used to.
Exactly.
Over a fondant fancy.
But Ian is a long-time technology journalist and gadget expert amongst various other tech-related accolades. And we thought that this week we would talk about the new spread of high-end Android phones now that they're all basically on sale. We've got the HTC One M8 that had a little bit of a head start, was released about 2-3 weeks ago. We've now got the Samsung Galaxy S5, which has gone on sale. The Sony Z2 review is in, and the key thing here is that we've reviewed them all, and all three scored 9 out of 10. And we had one slightly facetious commenter who posted one of our reviews to Reddit, who said, oh good, they've given them all 9 out of 10. That'll make the buying decision a lot easier. And we thought, fair play. So we've got an interesting roundup that's come up as well to sort of explain some of the differences. But we thought as well, because Samsung's released its Gear smartwatches, the Gear 2, the Gear 2 Neo, and the Gear Fit, we thought, what better opportunity to spend 5 minutes and talk about which we like the most and why, now that they're all out. Now, Ian, I cannot help but notice that you are wearing a Galaxy Gear.
I know. What a coincidence.
Watch.
I didn't even know that you were going to address this issue.
No.
This is the old one, though. This is the first generation.
That's the Gear. But in your opinion, so we scored these all the same. They're all kind of 5-inch devices, very high-powered, quad-core, you know, huge amounts of RAM, memory, screen resolution, all that kind of stuff. Of the three, because I think you've seen them all as well, which is your heart beating for, if you like?
I've got to say, I think the HTC at the moment. I think that is just a really nicely designed device. I think they've gone after the sort of the smart Apple idea of building things properly, you know, like a hardware that feels good in your hand, that kind of thing. And Samsung, as good as that phone is, it's still made of plastic, and that's missing something in that market where you're paying £600 or £700 or whatever, you know, £50 a month or however they work it out. You know, it's a lot of money, isn't it? So you want something that feels premium, and that phone just misses it slightly. It's still going to sell more than everything else.
It will, because Samsung has a huge marketing budget to its benefit, which HTC, to its definitely not to its credit, does not have the same sort of marketing spend that Samsung
has. Well, few companies do. I mean,
this is true, but it's interesting because this time last year, HTC's One felt like a premium phone, but it was a lot smaller. They've made it bigger for this edition. It's now 5 inches, possibly even 5.1 inches, and the specs now are higher. It uses the high-end Snapdragon processors, and it has more RAM compared to last year. So it's almost like last year, their sort of USP, if you want to use real terms here, was the fact that they had a real premium feel. It was bigger than an iPhone, but it wasn't that giant sort of hand-encompassing aesthetic that the Sony and the Samsung had. And they sort of seem to have said, well, okay, that wasn't working for us, even though it sold really well. And they've just made it bigger, and they've given it the high-end specs, and so it doesn't seem to have the same differentiation factor.
I think I actually preferred the design of the HTC One.
The original one.
To the M8.
But the new one's got the depth focusing camera, which in my experience works, but it works as a fun filter sort of feature rather than this is going to change mobile photography.
Well, interestingly, as I was standing in here listening to your wonderful podcast, I just had a press release actually talking about the fact that they've now got an SDK for that. So there will be people able to develop apps for that camera. So that's kind of an interesting idea.
This is breaking news.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it came in as I was listening to you. So that's a good conversation point.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's quite a nice idea. There could be some real exciting stuff there. I don't know what you could do with it, but when open.
You could certainly imagine lots of uses for it. I mean, a company that wanted to develop, I mean, somebody even like Instagram presently, you can't use that HTC depth camera, if you like, in the Instagram app. But with the SDK, developers who make Instagram could bake in support specifically for that camera. That could be very interesting, because there's no real use for it in video at the moment, and that's probably for good technical reasons, but maybe with this it has some entrepreneurial developers getting excited about maybe what they could do with it in video and that sort of thing. That could be quite cool.
Yeah, that maybe you can do something with motion tracking or all that kind of stuff, and you know, put in special effects in the phone. I mean, it's all a bit gimmicky, isn't it? But it's an exciting idea, and it's things like that that get me excited more than, I don't know, maybe a heart rate monitor doesn't quite do it for me, although I think that's clever.
Well, that's a good opportunity then to move on to talk about the Samsungs, which I think, Katie, you're quite a fan of playing around with since we've had them in. And the Samsungs, they definitely don't have that premium aesthetic that you were talking about.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they do have this range of gear accessories that go with them. And for background, we gave the Gear Fit, that's the smaller one that you wear on your wrist. It's not meant to be a smartwatch. It's kind of like a glorified Nike Fuel Band sort of system. It's very fitness focused. We gave that an 8 out of 10. It's not that expensive, I don't think. I think it's just in triple figures, something like that. It's about 100 quid.
I think that sounds right.
Something around that. It's a lot
which is about the same price as most other sort of wrist based fitness gadgets out there. In terms of the phones, I really like the kind of the whole Samsung package. What does annoy me is that I could never use the Gear Fit with another Android phone, and I find that kind of annoying.
It's annoying, but it does allow them to make the experience, if you do have both, a good quote unquote, depending on how you feel about what they're doing with it, but also B, it does give them a reason to buy that phone. And it does seem to me that in this generation, one of the good reasons to upgrade to the new Samsungs could be that, although actually now I think about it, I think those gears are all supported by the S4 and some other galaxies as well, so maybe that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
But it is lighter and thinner than the HTC.
Well, I think the S5 is much nicer than all the other kind of plasticky phones that Samsung has made, but it's still a plasticky phone. Out of the three, I probably would choose it because I do love the fit. I think it's one of the nicest kind of smartwatch fitness gadgets I've seen, and it's something that I feel like I'd actually wear and use.
And we can quantify that it is actually quite good.
Yes. So I think out of the three, I kind of probably prefer that one. But then again, I'm also a big fan of Sony's phones, and I know a lot of people find them too big and bulky, but I personally quite like that sort of heft. It's nice to have something that feels premium.
It feels premium, but it does also feel like you could beat an otter to unconscious states. Even though I agree, and it's a great phone. But Ian just pulled
that
out.
That's the Z1, it's not the Z2.
But you are a Z fan then?
Well, I was just testing this, just literally, because I've been doing a roundup of the best phones, and I do consider this to be a really good phone.
The Z1.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is really nice. I mean, it's got some clever features. You know, the camera's quite good. It's probably one of the best three cameras on the market, isn't it, in a phone?
Well, the Z1's camera, when it first came out, I actually thought was pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
There was a software update that I think addressed some of the issues, and in the new one, it does look a lot better, the Z2. So that's interesting. So you like the Z1, but you choose the HTC.
Yes, I do. Well, I do, because there's some things about the HTC that I really kind of get, and I love that dot cover case thing.
That is
such a nice idea. So simple, but adds a real sort of flair to it, but for nothing. You know, there's no extra cost really. I mean, there is some extra cost obviously, but you know, it's an affordable way of making your phone stand out, I think.
This is like a little, if anyone's seen those plastic glasses that Kanye West has worn that you see on market stores, they're kind of made out of plastic with slats.
Yes.
It's imagine like a really small one of those turned
but
into a
dots.
Phone. But with dots instead of slats. It looks like that, but it does allow you to sort of read the time and date in a kind of dot matrix format.
And it's not made out of hideous, shiny, cheap plastic.
No, and you can actually operate the phone through it to a basic level as well, which is kind of clever. I think that's a really smart way of doing it.
You can check your notifications, right?
Exactly,
and check the time, things like that.
But Sony's selling point, I think, could well be A, it has the largest of the three screens. It's 5.2 inches, which is larger than the other two phones by only a small portion of an inch, about 1.1 inch. But it also has Sony's emphasis on photography and image stabilization, and the S5 will shoot in 4K, but Sony's incorporated some really good optical image stabilization that it's borrowed from its Handycam line of camcorders, and will record 4K video at 50 megabits per second. And just for nerd reference here, I spoke to Sony to find out how that compares to the Handycam it released at IFA last year, and that records 4K at 60 megabits per second. So there's only 10 megabits per second difference in the amount of data being used to capture 4K.
You know, in theory, I mean, it wouldn't happen, but that's actually high enough data rate for the BBC. So you could actually deliver that as a program.
Ian used to work for the BBC.
Yes, but the HD rate is 50 megabits per second, so that's interesting, isn't it?
It is, and with the optical image stabilization there, the good lens that they've built into the phone, it does make it a compelling device to use as a photography and video capturing device. Plus, it's got a big screen, and Sony's got its music stores, ties into the PlayStation ecosystem very nicely as well, and I think that that's quite a compelling choice. But it's interesting, because presently, if I had to pick any of the three, having used them all, we've reviewed them all, I think I would probably go for the Samsung. And the reason for that is that I too find the Sony just a little bit too bulky. It's just a bit too big. And I'm an iPhone user primarily, so anything over about 4.3 inches feels massive. So going to 5.2 feels like I'm holding some sort of actual Holy Grail type tablet.
But to be fair, you spend more time on your iPad, don't you, than you do on your phone?
My iPad mini, yeah. I only buy trousers that an iPad mini fits in the pocket of.
And seems like a perfectly legitimate fashioned exercise to me.
Well, I just reminds me of when I used to try and squidge a CD Walkman into my back pocket, feeling like a real champ. But and so you would go for the HTC, Ian, though?
I would have those three, but they're all the wrong phone,
obviously,
because what you want is the Note 3.
The phone that I want is a phone that probably will exist, but doesn't right now, which is the Sony Xperia Z2 Compact. Which, you know, is...
All the power of the Z2, you know, but in a smaller body.
Yes.
Because they're the only ones that have really managed to do that, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
A small form
I was
factor.
Really impressed when the Z1 Compact came out, but unfortunately it only came out a few months ago, which means we're unlikely to see the Z2 Compact anytime soon.
I agree. But let us know, what do you think? podcast@wired.co.uk. And on that note, it's a great opportunity to thank Ian for very quickly and unpromptuly, what's the word?
Certainly not that, I would say.
To jump into the podcast. Ian, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's my honour. Thank you for having me, Chief.
Thanks, mate. And with that, we're going to jump into the feedback loop. This is the feedback loop, the section where we dedicate our mouths to your opinions. But the first one comes in from Derek, and he says, to add to the discussion on lossless and HD music from episodes 165 and 166, I noticed when trying out Kim.com's Baboom service that it has a lossless FLAC streaming option, which makes use of HTML5 and doesn't need any additional plugins, in Chrome at least. At the moment, you can only stream one album. I have no idea whether the service will take off, considering Kim's special, quote-unquote, relationship with the music industry, but just as a proof of concept, it's very promising. And he also goes on to say that as a result of using Spotify, he's kind of forgotten what CD quality sounds like, and when he listens to a CD, he finds it immediately obvious that you're missing out when you're using compressed audio. So PS, love the show, guys, keep it up. Now, I wanted to mention this in particular because I heard a rumor this week or at the weekend, I forget exactly when, that Apple may be launching a high-res iTunes music store service at WWDC, which is in about 2 or 3 months. And that would be very interesting and tallies with the fact that for quite a while now, Apple has been accepting high-resolution studio master files for iTunes. At the moment, it calls them mastered for iTunes, and it's basically they take the higher-res studio samples from the studios, that is, and then they use that higher amount of data and information to create a really good compressed version. Diminishing returns, in my opinion, but if they can then use those original files they've already got to create this new library of high-res music downloads that are higher than CD quality, then that could be very exciting. And I've heard that might actually happen this year. So keep an eye on that, Derek, and anyone else who's into downloading high-res audio.
The next one's from Omar, who says, thanks for the fantastic podcast. I attended a talk last night by Aral Balkan at the Royal Society of Arts about his concept of indie technology. The talk was titled Free is a Lie, and it was about how corporates like Google, Facebook, etc. are not actually for free and they're using us as products. I heard that line from Nate before, says Omar. After a very interesting and engaging presentation going through the different products and stats from Facebook and Google, Aral heavily criticised the new, unreleased Firefox phone, since Firefox is an open source product. He said he had it for a week to try it and it wasn't good at all. He also said that Firefox makes 90% of its revenues from Google, which is, according to my info, true. In the end of the presentation, he announced his concept of the indie technology and how us users, not the corporate, should own and be in control of their personal data. He's got an indie phone that he is hoping to crowdfund, and that will enable the users to own and control their data, and it won't be free. Which is actually a point that we've been discussing a lot, that if you want to keep hold of your data, you're going to have to start paying for things, people.
My immediate knee-jerk reaction to this was the reason people tend to use this stuff is because it does make things easy. Mm. It does come at the price of your own data and not necessarily knowing who's got it or what they're doing with it, but it does make life simpler. And for a lot of people, for right or wrong, that's enough of an attraction to use a service like Facebook or Google.
But that's also partially because nobody really knows what's happening with their data.
True. Well, have a look and have a look at what Omar was talking about. If you do a web search, a Google search or something, or Bing, Aral Balkan, that's ARALBALKAN for Nate, an indie phone, you can find what he's talking about, I imagine. Katie, why don't you let us know what Roma has been saying?
Roma has to say, "Hi all, I've been catching up on your podcasts today. Sorry I'm a bit slow, that's okay Roma. In the 27th of March episode, when you talk about Facebook's acquisition of Oculus Rift and possible uses for such gear, I can't believe you didn't mention Duke Dumont's I Got You music video. If this doesn't make you buy virtual reality helmets, not sure what else would convince you." And yes, I know that is a slight exaggeration.
The only way to describe this is, have anyone seen Alien, the film? Yes. Ridley Scott. You know how Alien's got like a massive back of its head? Imagine that entire head was a wearable black headset that you could put on your own face. That's kind of what this headset looks like in the music video. We've got a couple of screenshots in our show notes here. But the video, it is quite fun. The song, not so much, in my opinion. But it does. It sort of gives this this music video of a guy who puts on a headset and basically gets to live the life of his dreams for a day. It reminds me of that episode Better Than Life from Red Dwarf, when they got to play the Better Than Life video game. And there's a lot of him drinking champagne by a pool, watching girls swim, yeah, and things like that. And frankly, like, if that's what you want to do, don't need to buy a headset. Become a technology journalist. And then, yes, you'll get paid for that. So we had a few other emails, by the way, people talking about show length. We've been experimenting with our format. We had an email from Chris and from Daniel, from Leon and Karina, and a few people sort of mentioned show lengths. And so we've decided that something around the 40-minute mark seems to work quite nicely for everyone. Some people, a lot of people, want it longer. We've had requests for an hour and a half, several times a week.
You know, when are we going to sleep?
Exactly. And some people have said, oh, you went over sort of 45 minutes. It was about 48 minutes, I think, last week. So maybe that was a bit too long. So this length of the show this week is about between 40 and 45 minutes, depending on the final edit. And hopefully that should suit everyone who's after something quick and punchy, but not bordering on it's close to an hour to listen to. But keep letting us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Liv will be back next week. She will be talking about dogs, no doubt, because she has one. And with that, thanks to our guest Ian earlier in the show, Ian Morris, and to you two as well.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.